CSB Headlines. Iran's foreign minister arrives in Oman to deliver a message from President Ebrahim Raisi and discuss bilateral and international developments with top Omani officials. Russia's foreign minister accuses unnamed U.S. officials of threatening to physically eliminate President Vladimir Putin. And vandalism leaves 14,000 people without power in the U.S. state of Washington amid warnings that neo-Nazis want to spark a race war by targeting electricity stations. Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to Poor World News. Iran's foreign minister has arrived in Oman on an official visit to discuss major regional and international developments with high-ranking Omani officials. Upon arrival in Muscat, Hossein Amir Abdollahian said that he is carrying a message from the Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, to the Sultan of Oman, Haitham bin Tariq. He said the visit is an opportunity for both countries to discuss bilateral ties. Amir Abdollahian said ongoing crises in Yemen, Afghanistan, and Ukraine are the main topic of discussions in his meetings with Omani officials. The Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi has blasted Western states for their anti-Iran propaganda and hypocrisy regarding recent riots in the Islamic Republic. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed this issue in length with our guests.
Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi has blasted Western hypocrisy as regards the recent riots in the Islamic Republic. He says that the West promoted propaganda that portrayed Iran on the decline. He, however, said that Western powers also sent messages that they did not seek subversion in the country, and they're ready to resume talks on the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal. The president also says the riots were a multifaceted war on Iran, including by such powers as the U.S. and anti-Iran groups as MKO terrorists. Raisi also warned against attempts to undermine Iran's national solidarity. He says any such move will be in line with the enemy's strategy of undermining Iran's independence. Right, to discuss this, I'm joined by a couple of guests. Let me invite Fuad Izzadi, professor at the University of Tehran. Also with me is Marcus Papadopoulos. He's a historian, political analyst, and author, joining us from London. Good to see you, gentlemen, both. Now, Professor Izzadi, what is it exactly that authorities in the West want Iran to do? They want to revive the JCPOA. That's what they're saying. At the same time, they are openly supporting riots in Iran and even teaching them what to do, how to attack security forces and all that. And those, you know, as Persian-speaking, London-based TV channels operating as war rooms, and the West is just encouraging them, maybe, and even in some cases, funding them instead of stopping them. So what is it exact that they want to do?
Well, they want to overthrow the Iranian government. They have been trying to do that for the last 42 years. And the argument they are making in practice is that while we are working on overthrowing government, let's have talks to make sure that you don't have a nuclear program. That's the basic idea. And even for the talks, they drag their feet. And the reason they do that is that there's this contradiction that if you want to overthrow the government and then you want to have an agreement, Iran would not sign an agreement unless the sanctions are lifted or suspended, then that would result in less sanctions on Iran, which is counterproductive to the idea of overthrowing the government. That's why there is this level of confusion in the West. You know, I think what Iran has done in the last 42 years is to develop this culture of resistance. So you resist these pressures that is coming from the West. That's the number one thing you do. And the second thing you do is to make sure that there is a level of popular support. And the third thing that Iran has done is to not leave this negotiating table. Because if you do that, then the other side would engage in this blame game, that we wanted to reach an agreement and Iran is refusing.
Marcus, we have 1 minute left. Let me know if you agree with Professor Ezzedi.
Yes, I do agree. Ultimately, the West, principally America and Britain, seeks to overthrow the Iranian government, seeks the destruction of the Iranian revolution, and seeks to reestablish Western direct rule in Iran. How Iran was ruled under the Shah prior to the Iranian revolution. However, the West projects itself to the rest of the world as the defender of democracy, as the defender of international law. Therefore, the West, on the one hand, in public, has to be seen as seeking a diplomatic compromise with the Iranian government concerning, for example, the JCPOA. But on the other hand, in private, through subversion, the West is using various means at its disposal to not just weaken Iran, not just to try and weaken the Iranian economy, but also to vilify, to demonize Iran, the Iranian leadership, and the Iranian people. And naturally, the Western ruling elites do so via Western mainstream media. Western mainstream journalists are purveyors of deceit. They are peddlers of falsehoods, and they are spreaders of disinformation. Western mainstream media is neither free nor independent. Therefore, it is only inevitable that Western mainstream media will be employed by the Western ruling elite to project Iran to the rest of the world as a economic wasteland, as a land of tyranny, and as a land of savages. And then Western politicians in public attempt to distance themselves on occasions from what Western mainstream media is doing. So in short, it is an act by the West. Whatever the West says in public about Iran, we can dismiss entirely. It is what the West is doing in private through subversion, which reveals the true intentions, the true nature of the Western ruling elite when it comes to Iran. If the Iranian government was not to enter into these farcical discussions with Western governments, then Western mainstream media would project the Iranian government to the rest of the world as not being interested in seeking compromises, as not being interested in seeking diplomatic solutions. So the Iranian government, alas, has very little choice but to enter into these discussions. Even though these discussions are farcical, they are a complete and utter waste of time. The Iranian government has to play the game. But at the same time, the Iranian government and the Iranian people as a whole need to simply do what they have done since the Iranian revolution of 42 years ago. Focus on Iran, focus on the Iranian economy, and focus on the welfare of the Iranian people.
Okay, I appreciate your comments and insight. Fuad Ezzedi in Tehran, Marcus Papadopoulos in London.
And welcome back to everyone. Syria says all foreign occupation troops will soon be expelled from the country through resistance of its people and popular forces. The Syrian Foreign Ministry said people in the northeastern part of the country are going to struggle against foreign forces topped by the U.S. occupying troops. Said the expulsion of foreign troops and liberation of entire Syrian territory is imminent. U.S. military has for years stationed its forces and equipment in northeastern Syria. Now, the Pentagon claims that deployment is aimed at preventing the oil fields from falling to the hands of Daesh terrorists. But Damascus says the deployment is only designed to plunder Syria's resources. Former U.S. President Donald Trump admitted on several occasions that American forces were in the Arab country for its oil. Damascus says the U.S. occupation has cost Syria over $107 billion in oil and gas sector losses. And Russia's foreign minister has accused some U.S. officials of threatening to kill President Vladimir Putin amid escalating tensions between the two nuclear-armed powers. Sergei Lavrov said that unnamed officials from the Pentagon have threatened to deliver a decapitating strike on the Kremlin. He added the remark was a threat to physically eliminate Russia's head of state. He also warned Washington against possible consequences of such a plan. Previously, U.S. media reported that Washington would consider a strike on the Kremlin if Moscow uses nuclear weapons. President Joe Biden has also warned the world will face Armageddon if Putin uses nukes in Ukraine. But the White House says the administration is not seeking to overthrow Putin. The Ukrainian president says the situation across the eastern front lines is deplorable as the war with Russia grinds on.
Bakhmut, Kramina, and other areas in Donbas, which now require maximum strength and concentration. The situation there is difficult and painful. The occupiers are using all the resources available to them, and these are considerable resources, to achieve at least some advance.
Zelensky said that power shortages also persist across the country, with 9 million people currently without electricity. Officials have introduced emergency consumption restrictions in six regions, including the capital, Kiev. Russia has been targeting Ukraine's energy infrastructure for weeks. Moscow says this is in response to earlier strikes by the Ukrainian military on Russian energy facilities. Both sides have stepped up attacks recently on each other's positions, with each blaming the other for targeting civilians and non-military installations. The Russian President Vladimir Putin has signed a decree which bans oil sales to countries, imposing a price cap on Russian oil. Under the presidential order, any supply of Russian oil or oil products to foreign legal entities will be prohibited if the contracts for these supplies use a price cap. The ban will come into force February 1st and run for about 5 months. The move comes as energy markets remain volatile due to Western sanctions on Moscow over its war in Ukraine. The EU, the Group of Seven Developed Economies, and Australia reached an agreement on enforcing a ceiling of $60 per barrel on Russian oil in early December. Russia, as the world's second largest crude exporter, is firmly opposed to any price cap, warning that such an approach interferes with the market pricing process. Four power stations in the U.S. state of Washington were hit by vandalism amid warnings that neo-Nazis are seeking to stage a race war by targeting power grids. The tens of thousands of people were left without electricity due to the attacks. Local officials have yet to name who is behind the vandalism, but they said that federal authorities have recently alerted them about threats to electric grids. Similar attacks have also been reported in other states, and people with neo-Nazi ties have been arrested. In January, the Department of Homeland Security said the violent extremists had been developing credible and specific plans to attack electricity infrastructure since 2020. It said the power grid is an attractive target for extremists. And gun violence in the U.S. is back in the headlines as a nonprofit group says more than 6,000 children were killed or injured by gunfire this year. A gun violence archive has been tracking shooting incidents since 2014. It says the figure is the most recorded in a single year in the group's nine-year history. It says over 300 children, 11 years old or younger, have been killed in this period. The grim statistics come against the backdrop of the killing of a three-year-old girl on Christmas Eve in Kansas City in what police said was an accidental shooting. Last week, another study showed the young black people in the U.S. are disproportionately impacted by gun violence. U.S. has been suffering from an expanding trend of gun violence and mass episodes of mass shootings. Afghans have commemorated the martyrdom anniversary of Fatima Zahra, the revered daughter of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, by holding different ceremonies. Mourners have stressed the need for sticking to Hazrat Zahra's school of thought. Our correspondent, Rahmatullah Baghban, reports from Kabul.
Afghan capital Kabul this week hosted multiple ceremonies to mark the martyrdom anniversary of Prophet Muhammad's daughter, Hazrat Fatima Zahra. The events drew people from all walks of life and included prayers and giving lectures by the scholars on the life and services of Hazrat Zahra.
Fatimiyya or Hazrat Zahra's martyrdom anniversary brings a good opportunity to study and promote the lifestyle of the daughter of Prophet Muhammad. Hazrat Zahra lived a faithful and prosperous life. She can be a role model in all aspects of life, including virtue, society, politics, and family. Women and men can follow her right path and improve their lives.
The father of Fatima Zahra was the greatest man of all time, Prophet Muhammad. Her mother was also a holy woman. Thus, Hazrat Zahra grew up in the best environment and was trained well. She was the wife of the first Shia Imam and the mother of Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein. Such an elite and respected woman is both commemorating and being chosen as a leader.
The commemoration of Fatima Zahra's martyrdom anniversary comes as the Taliban have banned Afghan women from most social activities. Religious experts say that getting education and taking social roles by women are not against Islamic rules.
Hazrat Zahra was not only a revered figure personally, but also she used to present the society. She was in the position of an instructor and used to answer people's questions. In many cases, she used to be a leader instead of her father. It shows the role and position of a Muslim woman. Therefore, Afghan women are responsible to follow her school of thought and take bigger roles in the society. In Islam, there is no problem with women's education or work.
Participants in Fatimiyya gatherings also say that fighting against arrogance is one other lesson people can learn from Hazrat Fatima's school of thought. Afghan women consider Hazrat Zahra as their best role model. They also honor her services and sacrifices for the sake of Islam. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
Christmas has come, but the Zionist regime still denies Palestinian Christians their basic rights, like the regime does against Palestinian Muslims. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Middle East Eye wrote in this regard, "It is impossible to understand Palestinian national identity without recognizing its integral Christian component that exists side by side with the Muslim component. It's concerning that religious organizations who claim to care about Christianity worldwide remain silent about the present and future of Christianity in Palestine. Palestinian Christians have not just been an integral part of Palestine, but also liberation movement. The fabricated regime of Israel knows that well. Under Israeli colonial settlement policies, racist legislation and daily attacks, Palestinians of all faiths are subjected to the same human rights violations. This goes for the land and the people. On one hand, the Zionist regime continues its racist policy of preventing Palestinian family reunification while making it almost impossible for thousands of Palestinians and foreign passport holders to even visit Palestine, let alone invest, study, teach, or volunteer. On the other, it has pushed for the expansion of its colonial settlement projects, including in East Al-Quds, in an attempt to change its Palestinian identity. Additionally, settlement projects such as the construction of Givat Hamatos around Mar Ilya Monastery between Beit Lahm and Al-Quds, the transformation of church property in Jaffa Gate into new colonial settlements, as well as the attempts at turning the Mount of Olives into an Israeli national park, among others. Such acts of aggression are part of an ongoing process of annexation that, in light of the Zionist supremacist ideology of some of those leading Israel, will not stop until their greater Israel is consolidated. As they claim this phrase, with full annexation over the occupied West Bank. Under this perspective, there will be continued attempts to change the status quo of the Al-Quds Mosque compound, a move that is rejected by Palestinians, Arabs, and Muslims and international community. Such attempts have been understood by the heads of churches in Al-Quds as an attack against the concept of the status quo that has provided some of the most important Christian and Muslim religious sites in Palestine with clear regulations for centuries, way before the fabricated regime of Israel was even established. Despite violations committed against Palestinian people, they shall not surrender or give up on the message of hope, delivered from a humble grotto in Beit Lahm over 2,000 years ago. They also cannot be blind to the realities of the ongoing violations of Palestinian rights since the Nakba 75 years ago. Changing course is possible, however, it would need a significant change in how things have been dealt with up to this point. The Zionist regime must halt all unilateral actions and recognize and implement its obligations under signed agreements and international law. The European countries, the US, and others that believe in the importance of protecting the two-state solution must immediately recognize the state of Palestine on the 1967 borders with East Al-Quds as its capital and accept its full membership in the United Nations. It is worrying to see how certain parties that claim to care about Christianity worldwide have chosen to remain silent on the steps that the Zionist regime is taking on the ground, steps which are directly affecting the present and future of Christianity in Palestine, particularly in and around occupied Al-Quds. Those same friends of Israel that celebrate their pilgrimages should think a bit about the millions of Palestinians, including hundreds of thousands of Palestinian Christians, that are banned by the occupying power, that is, the fabricated regime of Israel, from celebrating Christmas at their holy sites. Christian Palestinians will continue to celebrate Christmas in Palestine, the birthplace of Christianity. It is part of their identity and their responsibility to preserve their traditions that certainly include celebrating Christmas, which they love to consider a Palestinian gift. part of their resilience is to keep their cultural heritage alive, to feel proud of their traditions, and to make sure, no matter the years of exile, oppression and occupation, that their people protect their right to live in freedom and independence, peace and prosperity, like all people worldwide. Food for thought. Salam and condolences to you on a day of profound grief. Since today, the 3rd of Jamadi al-Akhir, is the tragic martyrdom anniversary of the noblest lady of all times, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her, we present you a memorable hadith from her father, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. He who knows this knows her, and he who does not know her, known that she is part of me, she is my heart and my spirit, which is in my sight. Thus, he who harms her, harms me.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, consequences of cutting from family. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of the consequences of cutting from the family. Now, when we talk about this relation, which is some people, they do cut from their family, there are some consequences. Why? Because cutting from family, generally known as qat'i rahim in the Arabic, which is the opposite of sila rahim. Sila rahim means like having a good relation with the family. Now, in this term that we have, rahim means womb. Now, generally, when we talk about the sila rahim, we explain that rahim, because it means the womb, so sila means having a connection, having a friendship with those who have a relation to you through the wombs. Obviously, it is about the brothers and the sisters. The brothers and sisters, they should have a good relation even when they grow, when they have kids, maybe they become the grandparents. They should not cut from each other. Unfortunately, the system of the life, we can see that it is in a way that, especially in the Western societies or the Western world, people are disconnecting from each other. The family members are disconnecting. Everyone is living his own life. Children, when they become 18 years old, they try to get separate from their parents. And when parents are old, they have to think about themselves, taking care of themselves by themselves, and maybe going to an old age house. And we see that there is no one to respect them. There is no one to basically go and see them. And this disconnection has the consequences. And Islam says it has the heavy consequences. If you do not want to have those consequences, then you need to build a relation with your family, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the consequences of cutting from family. Now, when we talk about the consequences of cutting from the family, obviously the very first thing is that the person's life becomes shorter. Now, those who do not have a good relation with their parents, with their brothers and sisters who have cut from the family, this cutting from the family is basically making their life shorter, and they become sick very soon or very consecutively. So therefore, these issues which they face is because they're away from their siblings. They're away from their brothers and sisters. They're away from their parents. On top of that, we know that the respect of parents is very important in the Islam, and Islam gives importance to the respect of the parents. Therefore, those who leave their parents on their own, obviously there are some consequences. When Allah has created us, He had made parents the means of our existence. We must respect our parents because of this relation that we have. At least we cannot be born, we couldn't be born without our parents. Therefore, when He made them the one through which we came to this world, He made them our guardian, He made them our nurturer. Therefore, when they have done their duty to nurture us and they were our nurturer, now when we are grown up, it's our duty to take care of them when they're old, when they need us. It is not right to just send them to an old age house. Rather, we should take care of them the way we take care of our children. And don't say that they have done it because it was their duty. Islam is not like this. Islam says the way they took care of you, you must take care of them, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
10 minutes.
Senator from Vermont is recognized.
In mid-December, the White House and U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders clashed in the run-up to a Senate vote on the War Powers Resolution put forward by the Vermont Independent. Sanders' resolution would have put a definitive end to U.S. support for the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen by ending sharing intelligence for the purpose of enabling offensive coalition strikes and also ending logistical support for offensive coalition strikes, including providing maintenance and spare parts for Saudi fighter jets. But by the evening, Sanders had agreed to withdraw his resolution, saying he would enter negotiations with the White House on compromise language. The Intercept revealed that the White House was pressuring senators to vote against the bill, and the Democrats came out in opposition to Sanders' resolution. Sanders' justification for not holding the vote was that the Biden administration claimed it would work with Congress on ending the war in Yemen. But even if the White House really wants to engage with Congress on the issue, or if Sanders chooses to reintroduce the resolution, the plan will take time, which Yemenis don't have. A similar Yemen War's Powers resolution was passed in 2019 by both the U.S. House and Senate.
U.S. intervention in Yemen is unauthorized, unconstitutional, and immoral. And we must not, we cannot delay voting to end our involvement and our support of Saudi Arabia any further. If we do, we have ourselves to blame for our country's lost credibility on the world stage. And more importantly, our own consciences will bear the blame for the thousands of lives that will surely continue to be lost.
It is a vote to demand that the humanitarian crisis in Yemen be addressed. It is a vote that will tell the despotic dictatorship in Saudi Arabia that we will no longer be part of their destructive military adventurism.
However, the administration of former President Donald Trump vetoed the bill. The Biden administration's opposition marks a reversal on the part of top Biden administration officials, including Jake Sullivan, Samantha Power, Susan Rice, and Wendy Sherman, who signed a letter in 2019 calling on Congress to override then-President Donald Trump's veto of the Yemen War Powers Resolution. Anti-Yemen war advocates say now it is the ideal time to put forth the resolution, as the UN brokered truce in Yemen has expired more than 2 months ago, and the Saudis can resume airstrikes at any time. Since the onset of the war in 2014, the Saudi-led coalition has launched a wide-ranging aerial bombing campaign, carrying out thousands of airstrikes. The coalition also imposed an economic blockade on Ansarullah-controlled areas, including a sea and air blockade, worsening economic conditions for millions of Yemenis. More than 23.4 million people, including 12.9 million children, are in need of humanitarian assistance and protection, almost three-quarters of their entire population. A previously announced end to U.S. offensive support did not prevent devastating and indiscriminate Saudi airstrikes in Yemen, which occurred as late as March 2022. More than 11,000 children have been killed or maimed as a result of the war, according to UNICEF. Critics say the White House's opposition to the War Powers Resolution is, in fact, a gift to the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. In the words of Abdullah al-Aoud, research director for Saudi Arabia and the UAE at Democracy in the Arab World Now, despite the catastrophic failure of Biden's fist bump approach with MBS and the Saudi government, it seems that while MBS gets more brutal and emboldened, the administration doubles down on protecting him. The fact is, the American government has protected bin Salman legally in U.S. courts with a legal immunity request, protected him militarily with weapons and arms sales, and protected him politically with pressure on Congress to impede efforts to end the Yemen war. For three presidential administrations now, the U.S. has provided weapons and logistical support to the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. The United Nations estimates that 233,000 people have died in Yemen during the war, more than half of them due to non-combat factors like food insecurity and poor medical care. U.S.-made weapons have been used in attacks that left hundreds, if not thousands, of civilians dead and have helped keep the war raging for nearly 8 deadly years. In his first visit to the State Department as president, Biden said he was ending U.S. support for the Saudi-led campaign in Yemen.
This war has to end. And to underscore our commitment, we are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
But by December 2021, the administration had pushed an additional sale of missiles to Saudi Arabia through Congress. Biden administration officials have failed to condemn Saudi airstrikes at critical moments and haven't effectively pushed Riyadh to end the blockade that's keeping humanitarian aid away from civilians.
The president welcomes today's announcement of an extension of the truce in the Yemen conflict. The truce in Yemen, of course, was a key agenda item during the president's visit to Saudi Arabia, where he met with the king and the crown prince and with leaders from across the region. We're grateful for the leadership of Saudi Arabia throughout this truce process, as well as for the Sultan and leaders of Oman, who have also played an important role throughout. Now, this truce is now going on 5 months, has brought a period of unprecedented calm in Yemen, saving thousands of lives and bringing tangible relief for countless Yemenis. 5 months, which may not sound like a lot, but when you're talking about 7 years of war, thousands and thousands of Yemeni lives, it counts for a lot. And now we have a chance to extend this another 2 months.
On these grounds, it's quite understandable why the Yemenis are so cynical about the goodwill of the Americans when they promised to work out a truce or ceasefire that would benefit Yemen in the face of the Saudi-led aggression. The Biden administration has had 2 years to do what he promised with regard to Saudi Arabia and Yemen. The only tangible measure it has taken so far is making Sanders withdraw from his anti-war resolution. It's naive to suppose that the Americans will lift a finger to put pressure on Saudi Arabia to end the bloodiest war ongoing in the world. Supply chains more secure.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the Limelight.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and much of the Republican elite have been casting around for a way to derail Donald Trump's bid to be the 2024 Republican presidential nominee. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website Sanon.com has covered this story and gives us more details. It's no secret that Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and much of the Republican elite have been casting around for a way to derail Donald Trump's bid to be the 2024 Republican presidential nominee. It's a delicate operation, to be certain. Trump's allure to the GOP primary voting base isn't just that he triggers the liberals, but that he ruffles the feathers of the Republican establishment. It makes the deplorables feel powerful, watching people like Mitch McConnell and House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy bow and scrape to the ludicrous reality TV host foisted on them by their own voters. So the strategy is always about trying to find some way to undermine Donald Trump without provoking him, to unload personal invective on Truth Social in retaliation. Some of the maneuvering is behind the scenes. As Greg Sargent of the Washington Post documented this week, Senate Republicans helped slip an electoral count reform bill into a larger spending bill. The covert move isn't just about circumventing Donald Trump's plan to steal the 2024 election, but to do so in a quiet and highly technical manner that will likely avoid his attention. But mostly, Trump's opponents in the Republican Party are trying to brand him a loser. After Trump-backed candidates took a bath in the 2022 midterms, they fell behind non-Trump Republicans by an average of 5 percentage points. A number of Republican pundits and politicians stepped forward to declare him an albatross around the party's neck. Mitch McConnell repeatedly shaded Donald Trump by saying someone like him is unlikely to win. What will Democrats do when Donald Trump isn't around to lose elections? Snarked the conservative Wall Street Journal editorial board. GOP voters should give up on the idea that Donald Trump is a winner, argued the editors of National Review. Hopeful Republicans, opinion editorials predicting Donald Trump has lost his luster, have become a cottage industry. We'll see, of course, but there's no doubt that bad press is getting to Donald Trump, who seems incapable of even leaving his house these days. The announcement of his presidential run was conducted from the safety of Mar-a-Lago bubble, but even then it was lackluster at best. As Heather Digby Parton noted at Salon.com, the former president tends to wander aimlessly around at Mar-a-Lago, bored and lethargic, depending on his attendance to call around, to allies to ask them to deliver affirmations and cheer him up. He's even calling people who won their elections loser in his typical psychological projection. Calling Trump a criminal and a fascist may be accurate, but both trends tend to be assets for Donald Trump in the eyes of his base. But, the theory goes, if Donald Trump can be branded a loser, it will finally break the spell he has over his credulous base. Which is why Republican leaders should fall on their hands and knees and thank House Democrats for finally, after years of court battles, releasing Donald Trump's tax returns from 2015 through to 2020. Not because they reveal that Trump is a massive tax cheat, which only makes the base love him more. What's great about the tax returns is that they show that President Trump is about as good at business as he is at medical science. Despite his years of dubious claims to be a billionaire, the tax returns actually show that he spent most of his presidency losing money, hand over fist. This is a guy who used to brag that he'd make money by running for president, after all. that Donald Trump is a uniquely terrible businessman was known long before this. Back in 2020, the New York Times successfully obtained years of tax records, mostly from his pre-presidential life. Even those who had long been skeptical that a guy who hawked ringtones was really a billionaire were astonished at how very, very bad he is in business. The Los Angeles Times has also covered the same story and gives us more details. As the 2022 midterm election wheezes to an end, the start of the 2024 campaign feels both uncharted and uncannily familiar. Donald Trump began his bid for a comeback, the first attempt by a former president since Herbert Hoover, as the apparent frontrunner for the Republican nomination, who nonetheless appears vulnerable to a serious primary challenge. The fundamental question facing the Republican Party during this long run-up to the next election is who truly is in control. The elected officials and opinion leaders who have shaped their party's agenda from the top, or the grassroots bloc of Donald Trump faithful who have ruled from below. The latter may have shrunk in numbers since the former president left office, but they still command outsized influence in GOP primaries, and there may be just enough of them to propel Donald Trump forward in a crowded field of competitors. Republicans face daunting scenarios, an ugly primary battle that could aggravate ideological tensions within the party, or an easy waltz to the nomination by a candidate under the cloud of multiple criminal charges, criminal investigations and proven unpopularity with crucial voters such as women and independents. I don't believe that he is completely intractable from the Republican Party, said Mike Madrid, an anti-Trump GOP consultant. Mike Madrid added, "Here's what I do believe. I believe the Republicans have so swallowed the hook that when you rip it out, it will bring up all its guts and probably kill it. Republican elites have been here before, publicly breaking from Donald Trump after the predatory vulgarity of the leaked Access Hollywood tape, his equivocation in denouncing white supremacists in Charlottesville, and the 6th of January 2021 attack on the Capitol that was catalyzed by his false allegations of election fraud. But so long as Donald Trump was able to mobilize infrequent voters to back him on his endorsed candidates, his influence on the party was never in doubt. It may be different this time, though. In tones typically reserved for Donald Trump, media personalities are speaking reverently about Florida Governor Ron DeSantis' 19-point romp to re-election. The party's strong performance in Florida's congressional races also enhances Ron DeSantis' reputation for carrying down-ballot candidates to victory. By contrast, top GOP figures have pointedly noted Republicans have struggled in three consecutive national elections since Donald Trump won the White House in 2016. If a political party can't stay committed to their central premise, which is winning elections, then what's the point, said David Kochel, a veteran Republican strategist. There is some evidence the GOP is ready to move on. In a recent NBC poll, 62% of Republicans said they considered themselves more a supporter of the Republican Party rather than that of Donald Trump. The largest share since the question was first polled in January of 2019. Club for Growth, a conservative group once allied with Donald Trump, circulated polls showing that Ron DeSantis had a healthy lead over the former president in Iowa and in New Hampshire, the first two states on the path to the GOP nomination, as well as in Florida and in Georgia. Christine Matthews, a pollster who has Republican clients, said, The sense that primary voters are ready to look beyond Donald Trump is very real, driven by their belief that he is hobbled by his antagonistic relationship with the media. They're able to justify moving on from him by saying, the media will never give Donald Trump a fair shot. They'll always be against him. So even though we really like him and think his policies were great, it's probably time for someone new to take over.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In today's programme, we'll be looking at the recent imposition of sanctions on Press TV by Western governments. Later in the show, we'll be investigating how the Zionist movement has responded to this show, which has been on air now for almost a year. I'll be talking to experts on this subject after this special report by Latifa Abu Chakra on the sanctions against Press TV.
Press TV is under attack. Canada, the EU, the US and the UK have all issued new sanctions on Press TV as a whole. Some have also sanctioned specific broadcasters from the station. Though spurious reasons are given for the sanctions, the reality is that the West fears that their lies about Iran will be exposed. First, Canada sanctioned Press TV as an entity in October. Then the EU weighed in, imposing sanctions on a number of individuals associated with Press TV over alleged forced confessions of detainees following the recent US and Zionist backing of riots in the country. In reality, there have been no such broadcasts. The sanctions imposed by U.S. Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control, OFAC, target senior personnel of Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting, IRIB, and of the English-language Press TV network, including senior journalists. OFAC alleged that IRIB had broadcast hundreds of forced confessions of Iranian, dual national, and international detainees in Iran. The West has been gunning for Press TV for many years. The UK broadcast regulator fined Press TV £100,000 in 2011 for broadcasting a short clip of the confession of Mazia Bahari, a journalist who had been arrested as an alleged spy. Press TV refused to pay the fine. Its license to broadcast in the UK via satellite was revoked in January 2012. A key reason for targeting Press TV at the time was that it featured British dissidents like George Galloway and Ken Livingstone, who were willing to tell the truth about the British role in the illegal invasion and occupation of Iraq, and about the struggle of the Palestinians. In 2014, Bahari created a new citizen journalism website called IranWire. Its website was designed by a UK company called Small Media, which is known to be a front for CIA media operations. Unsurprisingly, US propaganda assets, such as Masih Ali-Nejad, had been prominently featured on the site. In announcing the sanctions, the US government also laughably accused Press TV of not being objective, of making false and baseless accusations, and of being involved in mass suppression and censorship. But these are all qualities generously exhibited by both covert CIA propaganda operations and the mainstream US media. Press TV provides a counterweight to the empire of lies presented by Western media. It is no surprise that the US wants its propaganda assets in the region not to be challenged and targets Press TV as a part of its ongoing regime change operation against the Islamic Republic.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. David's also the co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. Our guest expert today is Roshan Saleh. Roshan is the editor of Five Pillars, a Muslim news website based in the UK. He's been a journalist now for almost 25 years, having started his career in local newspapers before moving into TV journalism with London Weekend Television. He's also worked for Al Jazeera, Islam Channel,